Sounds True presents Peacemaking, Session 2, with Thich Nhat
Hanh.
So suppose now you have learned something from this war. You have seen all the damages that it has inflicted on your heart, your mind, your people, and on the people of Iraq and other countries. And then you know that I should not wait until things happen in order to react like this time. I should prepare now for a war that can take place in 10 years or 20 years or 30 years. Suppose you have 10 years in order to prevent a war. What would you do today and tomorrow and after tomorrow? If you find out the way of living, the way of being, the way of doing things in that direction, you find peace now. You will not be frustrated now.
My name is Tammy Simon, and in 1991, shortly after the outbreak of the Gulf War, I met with Thich Nhat Hanh and had the honor of conducting a rare interview with him in which I asked for his advice on how to respond effectively during a time of war. Here to introduce Thich Nhat Hanh is Vincent Harding, a professor of theology and author of Hope and History, someone who has been working for peace for over four decades, since his day as a friend and co-worker with Martin Luther King Jr.
It may be that our country has gotten so accustomed to going to war over these years that we haven't taken the time to get some space to look at some of the strange things that wars do. For over the generations, it seems to me that human beings have always been surprised by the strange and magnificent and totally unexpected gifts that can come out of war. And I think about that when I think about that marvelous human being who is being interviewed here. Because Thich Nhat Hanh is surely one of the most unexpected and one of the grandest gifts that we received from the terror that was known as the war in Vietnam. He is, in a real sense, a gift to us, a poet, a mystic, a religious leader, a social worker in the best sense of that word, one who has profound concern for the weak, for the poor, for the broken, for the lost, for the refugee, for the exile. I first came in touch with Thich Nhat Hanh when he visited Atlanta, Georgia in the late 1960s. His coming there, as I recall, was part of his own deep sense of connection to Martin Luther King Jr. and the African-American freedom movement of the time, the movement that has been unfortunately characterized as the civil rights movement. Thich Nhat Hanh understood that there was much more to that movement, much more moving at deeper levels than simply a quest for civil rights. He understood and was therefore deeply connected to the ways in which that movement was a movement for the development of humanity, the grander, greater, fuller opening of our human relationships to each other. And so he came to Atlanta partly attracted by the power of that movement, and specifically attracted by his sense of connection to Martin Luther King Jr. He had written to Martin late in the 60s while the war in Vietnam was going on, asking King to speak out of King's own sense of humanity, to speak out on behalf of the broken people of Vietnam, the vulnerable victims, that mass of children and older people and others who are always the vulnerable victims of war, no matter how just the war may seem to someone. He was in Atlanta because King respected him as well, and eventually King would nominate him for the Nobel Peace Prize. When I heard him, he was speaking to a student audience there, and he reported on his time traveling through our country and meeting student groups all over the country. And he said that he was deeply moved and very appreciative of the way in which the students constantly spoke about how they wanted the United States out of Vietnam now. They wanted the war ended now. They wanted a ceasefire now. And Thich Nhat Hanh, in his quiet, wonderfully smiling way, said that he really appreciated that, and that he told students everywhere how much he appreciated their sense of urgency that justice should be done and that the war should be ended. But he said, this idea of wanting everything now, he said, I want you to know that I have a different experience. We have been struggling for freedom, for independence, for peace, for justice in our country against outside invaders for decades, for centuries, and we have tried to learn some things. And one of the things he said that we have been learning is that it is necessary to struggle with patience. Struggle with patience. Now, from Thich Nhat Hanh, this was no easy platitude coming from the outside someplace, coming from some disengaged relationship to the world. No, we knew by then that this marvelous Buddhist monk, this small, quiet, powerful man, was coming to us as a representative of what he called engaged Buddhism. As a matter of fact, often when I have seen him or heard him, it has occurred to me how much he reflects Gandhi's satyagraha, Gandhi's attempt to bore into the depths of the Hindu teachings and to lift up this idea of satyagraha and to translate it for us in the 20th century as holding on to truth, whatever the cost. That's what I think of when I think of Thich Nhat Hanh. Because for Thich Nhat Hanh, the basic truth to which he grasps and holds with all of his life is the truth of our oneness, what he likes to call our interbeing. And that point of view, that way of seeing and being and living and acting, became eventually a position which helped to make him persona non grata in his own country. And so he is now an exile from that country because he dared to believe that North or South, they were all part of him. Communist or anti-communist, they were all part of him. And of course, in parenthesis, what he is saying to us in this day is that it is of great importance, even now, after the desert storm, to remember that we were directing the storm against ourselves because we are part of those Iraqi soldiers, children, families, and to know that is to know the truth about ourselves. So this brother from Vietnam comes to us as a gift with an invitation, as he calls it, to the practice of peace. And he says that we cannot practice peace either within ourselves or in the world around us unless we also recognize that we have an invitation to receive the gift of time, to use the gift of time. That, I think, is what he meant when he said to us a long time ago in Atlanta, we must learn to struggle with patience, to struggle within ourselves, to struggle outside of ourselves with patience, to struggle for peace, and to struggle for a new world. Not a new world order, but a new world of relationships, a new world of interbeing, a new world in which we sense how much we belong to each other. What a gift from the fires of Vietnam. What a gift, Thich Nhat Hanh.
Cửa tung đôi cánh khép, một mũi tên sáng.
Is peace possible in our time? This is the first question I asked Thich Nhat Hanh as we sat sharing tea in the house of a Vietnamese family in Houston, Texas.
Mặt trời nổ tung.
I think war is going on in our daily life. War between you and yourself. There are conflicting things within yourself. There's conflict between you and your husband or your wife and your children. War is going on all the time. And small wars lead to a big war. But you know that with mindfulness, with the practice of peace, you can transform war into peace in your daily life, inside of yourself, between you and other members of your family. So you know that it is possible to prevent war in society and to reduce them to a minimum. It is possible. In Vietnam, for instance, we had periods of 200 years without war, which is not so bad. And if we practice peace more, we may have longer periods than that. Depends on us. And practicing peace within yourself, so that there is no war between this feeling and the other feeling, this perception and the other perception. And the roots of peace take place in yourself. And then when you have more peace in yourself, and then with the more practice, you have more peace between you and another member of your family. And that way you extend peace to the society and the other society. This is the only way. I don't think there is another way.
What about going out and protesting the war? Demonstrating, being part of marches and rallies, more of the political avenues through speaking out against the government's actions. What do you think about that?
I think when you go out to protest against the war, you take it for granted that you are peace, which is not the case. Because you contribute, you have contributed somehow to the war by your way of life, your lack of awareness. If you have been very alert and have done your best among yourselves and friends and other people, things could not have been like this. So protesting against the policy of war means to protest against yourself, the kind of unmindful way that you live your life. So if you see that, and your protest will take another dimension, and anger is not directed to one particular person in the government, but directed to you as a community, as not having lived mindfully enough in order to prepare to have the capacity to avoid this war. In fact, we have to see the other person is us, the person we think that is responsible for war. He is us. They are us. We have not made enough effort to help them see things more clearly. We have not made any effort to help the seeds of peace and understanding grow in them. We are responsible, and we have to protest against ourselves. We need another kind of approach, the interbeing approach. I have been like this, that is why they are like that. You know, it's like if the parents are not happy, there's no way that the children can be happy. So you should not blame the children for not being happy. This is like this because that is like that. So the approach of love, of understanding. You can go to a demonstration in order to tell people what you think. This is my thinking, this is my feeling, this is my insight. We think this war is unjust, this war is destructive, this war is not worth a great nation from ours. Just saying that is useful. But if you do that to protest against someone, I don't think it is very fruitful. Especially when you are a minority, very small minority, they would look at you and smile. But when you say that I'm not protesting, I'm just trying to tell you, express my insight, my feeling, that's all, it will have more effect than if you use your anger in order to say, you are like this, you are like that, you are inhuman, you are, it can only damage more. And I think if we and our children know what to do in our daily life, to always plant seeds of peace and reconciliation in our heart and mind, well, we begin to have peace. We will not be frustrated, we will not suffer too much of anger and frustration. And this is a very good beginning in order to avoid another war. Suppose you will have a war in 10 years. Do you think that 10 years is enough for you to prepare yourself and your nation in order to avoid that war? Because our tendency is not to do anything and just wait for the event to come and react. That is not an intelligent way. So prepare yourself, whether you have time, whether you have 1 minute, whether you have 10 years or 1,000 years. 1 minute in order to breathe in and out and plant a seed of peace. 10 years is to prevent a war like the Iraqi war. 1,000 years in order to prevent total nuclear war that can destroy the whole planet. So if you don't have time, there's no use to talk, to discuss, because you cannot practice peace without time. So, do you have 1 minute? Yes, I have 1 minute. So use the minute in order to breathe in and out, plant a seed of calm, peace, understanding. Do you have 10 years? Yes, I have 10 years. Use the 10 years to prevent the next war. Do you have 1,000 years? Yes, with that 1,000 years in order to prevent the destruction of our planet, things like that. The Vietnam War was 16, 17 years ago. Between two wars, it's only that short period of time. So suppose in 10 years or 15 years, you have another war somewhere in the Middle East, in Europe, and in Africa. What should you do during that period of time in order for the war not to happen? So forgetfulness is our real enemy. Forgetfulness leads to non-action, non-practice of peace. So if we nourish our mindfulness every day, we plant the seeds of peace every day, in us and in the people who surround us, and there is a chance that we can avoid the next war.
I think many Americans see this war as a success. It was a big success. We only lost, you know, less than a couple hundred American lives. And the fact that 100,000 or more Iraqi people died doesn't really count in the eyes of many Americans as a loss. Now, I also know that there are other people in this country, you know, myself included, who feel that any human life is equally valuable. How does that kind of feeling develop in people or not develop in people? How come some people don't count those losses?
Because you are caught in the idea of self. You think yourself is America. But in the light of the practice, we see self is made of non-self elements. America is made of non-American elements. Think of it. And the destruction of non-American elements is the destruction of America. You have lost just 100 or 200 of lives, American soldiers. But you suffer many other kinds of loss. Think of what people in the world are feeling. The people in the Middle East, you don't have a lot of sympathy from the part of many people. Many people were sympathetic to America now turn to be very angry at you. So that is a big loss. And how many Iraqi soldiers were killed during the bombing? These should be counted as the casualties that America suffer. You see, because that's your work. And when your president say, God bless the United States of America, so he was praying only for American soldiers, and he did not pay attention to the lives of non-Americans in the war. And to us, this is not a good image of America. Selfish, arrogant, and that is the casualty you got. Not only by guns, by bombs, but by a statement. If Bush said that God bless us so that the war will end soon and that Americans as well as Iraqis will suffer the minimum possible, if he were able to say something like that, he would win a lot of sympathy from the people around the earth. But he didn't say that. That is why I said, well, you are caught in the idea of self. And self is made of non-self elements. Destroying the non-self elements is to destroy self. So just sit down and look deeply and to see the intensity of the real loss, the real casualties that America has suffered, is suffering from this war. Do not count the dead bodies only.
How do you view America at this point? You've been traveling and teaching in the United States now for 20 years. Have you seen a change in Americans, or if not, how do you see us?
I have been practicing patience, trying to be patient. I always tell my students that I have enough patience, because each student got to have his time or her time for transformation. So I'm not angry, I'm not frustrated. If I have 5 more days to live, and then I will do my best during these 5 days in order to plant some seeds of peace and understanding in the heart of people. I think that the seeds of peace exist also in the people whom we call people of war. It's only that they do not have friends that help water the seeds of peace and understanding in them. That is why the seeds of anger and the seeds of aggression become manifested and dominating in them. So we should not be discouraged. We should approach them with love, with patience, in order to help watering these kind of seeds in them. And that is the only way. Getting angry at them doesn't help, because they are us. And I hope by my way of looking and doing things, I can influence a number of friends. And I believe that one person is a lot. If that one person perseveres, using her time, her energy, her smile, her words in order to help watering the seeds of understanding and peace in the heart of people around. I do not have the tendency to condemn anyone, anybody. They are all my brothers and sisters whom I have to help. I only ask the question as whether I am skillful enough, polite enough, kind enough, understanding enough in order to approach them and to help them. I don't think that blaming can help in at all.
Do you feel it is ever justified to use violent means in response to a violent action? To use violence in self-defense?
Now, if someone broke into your house and tried to kidnap your daughter or kill your husband or something like that, what should you do? Should you adopt a more non-violent way? Well, it depends very much on your state of being at that moment. If you are prepared, and then you react more calmly and intelligently in a more non-violent way possible, you will be able to do that if you are ready. And in order to be ready and to react with intelligence and non-violence, you had to train yourself before, maybe 10 years or more like that. So wait until that time in order to ask a question is too late. So I would like to try to avoid giving an answer. It's not very helpful. Even if at that moment you know that non-violence is better than violence, you know the principle that you should love your aggressor also. That is only your intellect. It's not your whole being. So you cannot act according to that because you have a lot of fear. You have a lot of confusion. You have a lot of anger that prevent you to act with intelligence and in the most non-violent way possible.
I know you've led retreats with Vietnam veterans, and I wonder if you can speak a little bit about the person who's coming back from a war and the kind of healing and the kind of welcome that you think they need. How can we treat these soldiers coming back and the Vietnam veterans that are still in this country?
I think the Vietnam veterans, I think the Iraq veterans also, they have hidden pains within themselves. They have pain that they can be aware of, but they also have pains that they are not aware of. And I think it's very important to help them to be aware of the pain that they have in their consciousness. And one of the ways is to be aware of these pains yourself. Project these kind of pains on a screen in order for everyone to see, to show your understanding to the person who is carrying the pains in his unconscious. That is the most healing thing of all. And looking into the nature of these pains in order to transform them, in order to learn and to help not inflicting on our consciousness and on the collective consciousness the same kinds of wounds again in the future. I think that should be the practice of the whole nation, and not just a few psychotherapists with their clients only. Suppose you have a good filmmaker that has an eyes that can look deeply into the unconscious of a Vietnam veteran. And the image, the substance of pain that he sees with his penetrating eyes should be projected on a huge screen for the whole nation to see and to understand. That is collective meditation of the whole nation. And we learn as a community the causes that have led to this kind of wound. And by seeing these causes, we bring about a transformation and healing. And we also bring about the kind of understanding, the kind of determination that could prevent the individual consciousness and the collective consciousness to be inflicted with the same kinds of wounds in the future. I think that would be the practice of peace. And meditation is done like that on a national scale. We need artists to participate in meditation because they have their art, they have their way to explore, to look, to reveal, to show.
I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about your experience during the Vietnam War. I've never heard you talk about it, and just to understand your way of responding during that war, how you reacted, what you learned from that experience.
I learned that the source of suffering comes from the lack of understanding, the idea of happiness that people have, the lack of understanding of the real situation. Even if you have a lot of goodwill, you cannot do anything. The more goodwill you have, the more destructive your action can become. So it's not a problem of goodwill, but understanding. If you understand, and then you'll be able to avoid suffering. As a practitioner of Buddhism, I was able to see the suffering not only of the Vietnamese people, but also of the American people. When you are a soldier and you are holding a gun, you got to have some anger in order to be able to kill the soldiers on the other camp. But when you are a practitioner, you look deeply into human beings and you see that an American soldier suffer just as much as a Vietnamese soldier. And not only I suffer the loss of the Vietnamese, but I also suffer the loss of American young people. They were sent there to kill and to die, just like the Vietnamese. And they had to obey to a policy that is decided somewhere else, not in the battlefield. You see, now if you look back at the Vietnam War, with that huge amount of energy and material resources you pour on Vietnam for the destruction, if you had used that amount of energy and time and money to help both North and South Vietnam to rebuild themselves after the war with the French, and you become a good friend of both North and South without trying to exploit them, I think that amount of energy and time would win you very big brothers, friends in the world, you see. But the problem remains as whether you have learned the lesson. Suppose now you have another problem in Central America that is similar to or Vietnam. Would you repeat what you have done in Vietnam? Or would you try something else? And if your mentality has not changed, if your way of seeing things has not changed, if you don't have better insight into the reality of the world, and then you will do exactly what you have done in Vietnam. One time I was making a joke like this. Maybe in El Salvador or some other country in Central America, instead of supporting the anti-communist, why don't you support the communist? Try something different. Because the dollar, when you pour on one side, you corrupt that side. So pour your dollars on the communist side in order to corrupt them, and you get a victory for the anti-communist. That was a joke, but maybe it contains truth in it. That is a koan, subject of meditation for America. I think the best way is to make friends with both sides. All men are our brothers. That's a very old saying. If they fight, they struggle hard, it means they suffer somehow. Otherwise, why should they fight hard? They are suffering something from something.
One of my concerns is that people listening to this will think, you know, this is all very kind and very nice, but this monk doesn't have really the political sophistication that it takes to understand what's happening in the world right now. And this is, it's very complicated political issues involved, and it's not just about a daily mindfulness practice for several thousand people. That's not really going to make much of a dent in the world. How would you respond to that kind of criticism, I guess?
I cannot say anything in response to that. It's like when you say that Jesus was not very practical when he said, well, if someone slap you on the right your face and then you offer your left face, this is not very sophisticated way of dealing with the situation. What I said is that insight comes from deep looking. Deep looking in order to see that the suffering of the other person is our own suffering. And making the other person happy, you get happy too. And this is not something unrealistic, you see. When you make your husband happy, when he blooms like a flower, of course you see him like that, you are happy, right? Happiness is not an individual thing. If the other person is not happy, there's no way that you can be happy. Is that a kind of idealistic statement? It is based so little on reality. So I'm saying things like that. Not something nice to say, but something very concrete and can be practiced now and here. So do you want complicated things? Or do you want simple things that can be realized? And complicated things are used in order to hide the truth. The plain truth is what you need. When you are angry, you are angry. When you are selfish, you are selfish. When you are violent, you are violent. That is simple. You cannot say like this, well, I might look as if I am selfish, but because you don't see, there is this, there is that, there is this, there is that, that is why, although I look selfish, but I am not really selfish. You are trying to conceal the plain truth. And you say that you are sophisticated. But that kind of things can only make more trouble and make people more confused. To me, the truth is simple, plain. When you kill a person, you kill a person. When a person is dead, he is dead. When you need gasoline, you just say that you need gasoline. When you need to be in control, you say that you will need to be in control. You don't say, I do that because I want to help this person or the other person, this nation or the other nation. So why trying to avoid telling the truth in the most plain, simple way? Another thing, I do not enjoy fighting. I try my best to be myself, to be what I say. There is no contradiction between my insight and my way of being. I'm not trying to say something nice in order to soothe people. And I try to offer some practical way, like when I talk about Vietnam, you see. Well, if you are sophisticated, if you were smart, if you were intelligent, if you were understanding, you would not have wasted your time, energy in Vietnam like that. Now, the Vietnamese also made mistakes. The Americans made mistakes. But the fact remains that whether we have learned something from our mistakes, if there is another Vietnam, would you do it better? Would we do it better? Would America be able to use energy, resources, in order to win friends, to make North Vietnam into a friend, and to make South Vietnam into a friend? I mean, just by helping the rebuilding of the two parts of the countries, I think it's possible. It is a possible thing to do. You could have done it. You could help South Vietnam. You could have support North Vietnam. Because both sides need medicine, food, building bridges, building schools, and people will not refuse your help when they see that your help is not contained any intention to colonize you or something like that, you see. And that makes America greater. Now suppose you think of Iraq. You have a heart. You should think of how to make friends with Iraq again. Iraq as a whole nation and not just a portion of the population. How for America to become a friend of Iraq again. And showing that you want to become a friend without the intention of making ills, dominating. Suppose 100,000 soldiers died during the bombing. It means there are 300,000 or 400,000 people who have lost their father or their big brother. And what you will do in order to comfort these people? Say something to them. Address them directly. We know that you suffer because of our bombs. This is already a good thing, an act of reconciliation. Before you do anything, just expressing yourself that you see it, that you see the suffering, and you are co-responsible. I did not drop the bomb myself, but my brother did. So I feel co-responsible. We are sorry. Just saying like that is already an act of reconciliation. And what you can do more, well, will proceed from that point, you see. So understanding is the starting point. I think after Vietnam, reconciliation has not been even made between the two nations. 17 years already have passed and reconciliation has not been made. And that it was the practice of peace. And now you have another another war on your back. It's not ended yet.
Châu bao chất đầy thế giới, tôi đem tặng bạn sáng nay.
This concludes Peacemaking with Thich Nhat Hanh, music by Sister Chong Kong. To order additional copies of this audio learning program, or to receive a free catalog of over 400 audio and video tapes, please visit the Sounds True website, www.soundstrue.com, or call 800-333-9185, or write the Sounds True catalog, P.O. Box 8010, Boulder, Colorado 80306. Thank you for listening.
Là bao phép là yên bình, chim hót thông reo hoa nở, trời xanh mây trắng là đây, ánh mắt thương yêu sáng tỏ.